Exploring the importance of having the right skills to succeed. This is Skillfully Speaking, supported by Babcock International, presented by Skills Ambassador Jackie Grubb.
Welcome to Skillfully Speaking. I'm your host, Jackie Grubb, and I can't wait for today's conversation. My guest is someone you'll probably recognise, though perhaps not realise the full extent of his remarkable career. From military life to television, I'm delighted to welcome former SAS soldier, writer, broadcaster, and motivational speaker, Colin McLachlan. Hi, Colin.
Good morning.
The morning after the night before.
I know what a great night was last night. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, welcome to Plymouth and welcome to Skillfully Speaking podcast. And I'm going to go right into the first question. And obviously, in the last 24 hours, I've got to know you a little bit. Let's go back to the beginning, because in your memoir, you talk about the lack of direction when you were growing up. So what do you think was missing for you at that stage of your life?
Yeah, I don't think it was as much a lack of direction as it was probably not a typical childhood. Although probably for the infantry, there's a lot of people that come from broken homes and rough upbringings. Mine was violence and stuff. And I think there was a bit of something missing from the maternal side. And so I grew up in a very small village. There was only me. And I think sometimes you're a product of your environment and that you don't know what you don't know. So I wasn't really surrounded by a lot of kids my age that I could compare childhoods with. So I just thought it was normal. But yeah, it was great, my upbringing. But I always think those sort of experiences, they help you because you learn as much from negative experiences. So probably the stuff that happened to me as a kid probably made me a better dad and brother and partner. So I think that stuff's probably helped me in many ways.
That's really beautiful. Thank you for that. And, you know, I haven't heard anybody say that before, but I say probably nearly every day that we are a product of the environment that we're in. And whether that's in our professional life or our personal life, it just says the same. What would you say to young people today? Because there are plenty of people out there at the moment that are disengaged or they feel that they don't belong. So what would you say to them right now?
The world today, because of a lot of things, social media and everything else, we have an idea of what we're supposed to be, how we're supposed to think, look, act. And I think we want to shape our own way in the world because we need that. And so there shouldn't be this pressure to conform to any way of thinking or looking or what you're passionate about. I think we need that individuality. And I think schools are getting a little bit better in being able to deal with a bigger spectrum of people within the classroom. But I think it's important that we allow people to flourish in what they want to do and not try and drive them into pigeonholes of things that they might not want to. And although the world's getting slightly better in one way in terms of being able to accommodate very different people in how they think and act and look, I think in the other sense, we have this social media wave that's everywhere. And sometimes when things used to happen, whether it was bullying, whether it was how you should look or be or whatever, it was only during the classroom. Now with social media, it's 24/7. So you can be home at night and you'll still see this sort of never-ending vision of what you're supposed to be. And I always think if you follow things that you're passionate about, it'll feel like you're not working, you know, you're doing something that you have energy about. And we spoke about that last night in terms of finding something that you have energy for. And it helps you go those extra yards, which is something really important today, that we have that ability to go the extra mile with what we're doing.
Do you know, I was really grateful for that last night because we had that conversation and, you know, a lot of the time I'm so used to asking the questions and then asking other people. And then I was actually quite taken back when you asked me that question. And I've thought about it overnight and I'm not going to forget it now. But we did have a conversation about who we are, where we want to be, what is life all about. And there's so much focus. And I do think a lot about the sense of belonging and the sense of community. And again, whether that's in my professional world or in a personal space, that belonging is so important. And you actually talked quite a lot about joining the military And it sort of sat in my heart because when you were giving your inspirational speech, you were talking about for the first time you felt a belonging and you felt a home and you felt an environment that you felt cared for and people were taking interest in. And then as the inspiring speech was going on, then you talked about it was actually shaping you, wasn't it, into the person that you are today?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in the fact that in your early years, as you go into your teens and before that, you're on a trajectory. And so like we've talked about before, this kind of product of your environment, everything that shaped that journey sets you on this path. And if some things are missing or you have other things, then that kind of shapes where you're going. So, yeah, I joined the army at 15 and I never really saw my parents again after that. And for once, I had this sense of family, belonging. People were around me that wanted the best for me and for the team. And there was this sense of people wanting you to do well, to succeed. And I hadn't really had that before. I enjoyed that feeling and I was able to flourish in it. Remembering all that stuff has given me the sort of ammunition to be able to do that for other people, whether it's my children, whether it's friends or family or anything else. And I think the army does that. It has this sense of structure. It has this sense of security in terms of you're going to have, it might not be a roof over your head as such, but you're going to be looked after and you know what's in front of you. Yeah, it's going to be tough, but that sort of tough enduring, which we're kind of lacking in today's society. We don't want people to endure. We protect them, which does in some senses, but when life gets tough, and it will, we don't prepare them for that necessarily. And so there should always be this element of adversity and endurance and resilience that we want to equip young people with so that when they do come across these problematic, challenging times in their journey, they're able to deal with it and able to deal with it better.
And that's why I feel so proud of our Skillfully Speaking podcast, because for whatever reason, all this stuff comes out. So just moving on to your military career, joining the SAS at 23, what qualities did you have then?
I was really young and I also didn't have a lot of experience on selection. I was from a unit called the Royal Scots and we didn't have a lot of people in the SAS and we hadn't had anybody in for a very, very long time. And so I wasn't really equipped with what selection was about. I'd been in the army since I was 15, so although I was only 23, for my age, I was relatively experienced. But more importantly, I had resilience. And so there was only 6% passed on my selection. And if you took us all and stood in a line, we don't stand out for
6%.
Yeah. It's got a very low pass rate. And I think because it's long, it's enduring, it's 6 months, you're under microscopic scrutiny. And also because you need a bit of luck, you know, if you're injured at any part, it doesn't give you time to recover. So I was lucky. I was a fan that got to play for my team. I read all the SAS books. I was interested in the SAS and I was just lucky. I always say it's like any other military course. It was just a really hard one with a low pass rate and I managed to come out the other side. But I think resilience was the one key quality because everybody there was physically fit. It wasn't about that. It was about who was going to keep going when they were tired and thought they had nothing left. And that's one of the qualities that got me through.
And resilience is a word that you hear every day now, and talking about it within the SAS, I mean, I'm sure there are things that you can't tell us. Is the process still the same? And is it still a thing?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's not quite the same now. It's slightly shorter. And I think they've had issues getting people through selection. And I think that's a reflection on society as a whole. I think we've lost a little bit of that ability to endure at the very highest level. And so some things are shorter. So it's no secret that I think the Hills phase is a bit shorter now. So it's changed slightly. It never used to. It was the same for a very long time. And I think the military also got quite busy, so it was quite hard to get people to prepare for it. So they were going from operations to operations, because that period from about 2003 onwards was really busy in the military. So you had a lot of operational burnout. You had a lot of battle fatigue, a lot of other issues, and also the fact that soldiers weren't getting time to train for selection, so they were turning up and probably weren't their best representation of themselves. So there was a lot of reasons for selection changing, becoming shorter. It might not be easier, but it's certainly shorter than it was in certain phases. So yeah, it's got a little bit that way, but society's got a little bit that way because there's a sort of onus on protecting ourselves. There's mental health issues. There's a focus on that, and rightly so. But we want to protect ourselves. We don't want people to even feel a little outside their comfort zone. And like I said before, there's a lot of good in that. But again, when it comes to adversity, we're probably not equipped to be able to deal when things get tough.
Yeah. And then within our conversations, we've talked about that journey in life, how it prepares us for the next thing. And we develop skills, don't we, then to operate into other walks of life or new ventures. And the word resilience is a word that we hear all the time. Being resilient and then coupled with so much fractured mental health in the world. When you think of what you learned through the skill of being resilient, and then you've done so many things since then in different ways, what tips would you give to listeners in navigating their own lives and how they can be more resilient?
Well, if we all think back to a time when we were about 6 months old and we're learning to walk, we didn't know we could walk, but we were going to try. We were going to really try. And none of us got up first time and just walked. We fell over. We hurt ourselves. We weren't embarrassed by failure. We weren't put off by the fact that we'd scuffed our knees. We'd hurt ourselves. We were going to keep trying, maybe hundreds, maybe even thousands of times, until eventually we got up.
Oh my God, I love that.
It tells us that even as we're born, we have a tank full of resilience. And depending on what we go through in life, successes, failures, trauma, social stuff, stuff at work, stuff with family, that resilience tank goes up and down. But that should give us hope, because it means a resilience tank isn't full. It's not a 68%, 92%, and that's it. We can change that resilience. We can grow it. We can grow that within ourselves, putting ourselves in challenging situations. And yeah, anybody that's been through trauma, through anything, will know that after you've been through that, you protect yourself, you create a shield against that trauma in the future. And that's what resilience is being able to respond to that stuff in a way that gives you the best chance of success.
So do you know, there's something in that, isn't there? That's such a really good example, because learning to walk, you're going to have to do it anyway. So there's no overthinking, because you've just got to get on with it.
Yeah. And there's no secret in the fact, if you took two identical people, and you had one with a really clear, easy life, and then you had another that had to stumble through challenges and adversity and resilient, that person that's been through that challenge and journey has added so much stuff to their armory of stuff to be able to equip them for the future. It's not saying one path is right and one's wrong, but I think when you go through those journeys, it gives you something. It gives you a steel for stuff that comes at you in the future.
And you know what, in this life of perfection, gosh, if I knew then what I know now, I mean, we can all say that, can't we? And then there are things that you experience or you think, and you think you're the only person in the world that are experiencing it. Nothing is perfect, is it? And everybody has their traumas. Everybody has those things that happen. But I think the learning now, and something that I'm really conscious of, is the support and navigating and nurturing people through those things to be the best that they possibly can.
Yeah, 100%. And I think we all say everybody's different. There will always be someone that's been through similar challenges that you have and had varying successes of coming through them. And it's one of the things we do within the charity sector. We pair people up that have had similar journeys to show them that there's a whole army of people that have been in similar journeys to you. They might be slightly different, but they've either come out the other side or they haven't. But either way, they've learned from it and they've learned what's helped them and what works. And that's what sets up our communities. And like you alluded to earlier, you join the military and you join this family. You're suddenly part of something, which is one of the things that veterans miss, servicemen and women, when they leave the forces. They lose that community. And that's one of the things we try and pick up within the charity sector, is we try and recreate those communities of like-minded people to help them on the journey, because there's kind of strength in numbers with that.
Yeah. And obviously Plymouth, with a large naval base, veteran city, interviewing and employing veterans, I clearly see that. So tell us a bit more about your charities then. What are they called? What do you do in terms of supporting?
Yeah, and it was good to see as I was coming into Plymouth, I saw all the stuff for Armed Forces Day and they're setting up down on the waterfront
which
is tremendous. This is, well, over 10 years ago now. I think after the Channel 4 show finished, the SAS Who Dares Win show, and I'd done the first series, and there was a lot of veterans reaching out about different things that were going on in their life. And at first, I was really happy to respond to them and try and help, and I was getting overwhelmed. I couldn't deal with it. There was just so much, and I felt like people were slipping through my fingers that I wasn't being able to answer them in time. And so my friend Callum McLeod, who is Kingsown Scottish Borderers and had his own issues from Northern Ireland and stuff, we put our heads together and, as he would say, on the back of a cigarette packet, drew up a plan for really creating just a community that developed into the charity, which is now called Who Dares Cares. And it set off as a number of just meets in different locations, walk, talk and brews, we called it, where you come together, we go for a walk, we have a brew and that's it. Where there's no onus on anybody to open up, talk about their service, talk about their challenges. But as that community grew and people felt comfortable in their environment, they became products of their environment. And so they felt free to be able to open up about stuff that was going on. And as they did, other people were saying, I'm exactly the same. And I use my own story as an example. I always thought I was fine when I left the military. I had the same issues as I thought everybody else had. I had problems sleeping. I had this sort of hyper attention thing where I was sitting with my back to the wall. I was checking exits. I was studying people. I was thinking about means of escape, improvised weapons, what to do if things went wrong. And it was exhausting. And when I went along to a place called Veterans First Point in Edinburgh, I was actually just going along there to see some of the guys that were along there. And the guy there said, are you okay? Everything going on with you? I said, I'm fine. I said, it's just my sleeping. He said, well, let's have a chat. And when I had a chat with him, he said, you know, all these things that you're describing, that's PTSD. I said, no, no, it can't be PTSD because all my friends are the same. He said, yeah, they've all got PTSD. It's like what we went back to at the start. You're a product of your environment. Yeah. You don't know what you don't know. And if you're surrounded by people that are all the same, you just automatically think everything's okay. But until you have that perspective, until you have something to compare it to, you don't know.
Sleep is the most important thing. So actually, you underestimating something like sleep, the bigger picture of that is absolutely huge, isn't it? And the nutrition side of things and the exercise, which I'll come back to in a minute. But in terms of male mental health, it could be said that males feel they need to be strong, they need to be tough, they think they could be the breadwinners and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's very complex because depending on either your position, your role, the job that you do, it can be easier or harder to be able to identify that there's stuff going on mental health. And let's be clear, mental health is like physical health. It's like a frequency. You're on a journey and it'll be here and then it'll be here. Yeah. And all we want is to protect ourselves when we're at the very lowest part of that frequency to make sure that we get out of it. Because it only takes a bit of bad fortune, circumstances for us to be at the bottom of that frequency when we make the worst decisions for ourselves. And so we want to protect ourselves, surround ourselves with good people that recognise when that's happening and are able to pull you out of that sometimes when it happens. But certainly a place like the SES, that would be one example of a sort of, I suppose it would be considered a sort of alpha dominated environment where, you know, it's not great to talk about your mental health. You're just supposed to be able to deal with it. The military's got slightly better in that. But when I left, there was nothing. So after my capture, there was no debrief. There was no how you do nothing. I just got moved to another position, did a different job. Yeah. Now, that's okay, but that could have been quite bad. So now we have a process, I think, where you do some kind of post-incident debrief. You also have, you'll laugh at this, but this is where the military went. They recognised that sort of post, I don't know, 2006-ish, they started to do a thing where when you were doing rotations through Iraq and Afghanistan and things were busy, they would stop off for 3 days in Cyprus and do water sports and get drunk. And they thought that cured everybody. You know, that was you. That was your decompression. You won't be surprised to know that wasn't the answer. Mm. But it was a step by the military to try and do something. Now they have these trauma-informed managers. And again, it's a good idea in that they're informed about trauma and the signs and how to deal with it and the support. Unfortunately, it was a lot of the senior positions that held those. Now, there's an inherent flaw in that, that if all the managers are that and you're wanting to be seen
see
a
that.
Certain way, it has to be people your level, you know, or below. It has to be people of a similar rank that you're able to approach them and say, oh, I've got all this stuff going on. I'm just struggling to process it or deal with it, or I can't get it out of my mind, or it's occupying me, or I can't sleep, or there's a million different symptoms. It's being able to get the best support for that. So we're not quite there yet with the military, but we're making steps. But we see as a charity, we see on a daily basis that growing number of people that are coming out the shadows for different reasons. And one of our biggest challenges is having that person come to us ourselves, because with all the best intentions in the world, if a friend or family member comes and says, John, Sue, they're having an issue, they're dealing blah, blah, we can't do anything. We can't force ourselves on anybody. So we need that person to take the first step and just say, you know, I'm struggling with X, Y, and Z. Then we can get involved. That's one of the biggest challenges I think we have.
And there's a real importance, isn't there, around psychological safety. And sometimes we think we're doing good by doing something. But people say to me all the time, there's health and wellness and it being quite aesthetic. But actually, what's actually going on underneath to create sustainability in terms of the medium long term as well?
Yeah, 100%. And even people that are the closest people around fail to see signs, because sometimes the signs aren't there. I use my own brother as an example. I was around the world, you know, rescuing people. I came back home, found out my brother was having issues. And so I thought, you know, I'll save him. Took him out of his house, brought him in with me, tried to help. And just the very week that I thought, there's some stability now, he's in a good place, you know, we're doing stuff together, he's relaxed, he seems himself, that's the time he completed suicide. And so I think we have to be wary about our own impressions of how our friends, family member, people we know are doing, because we never know what's going on behind the scenes. So I think that part's tricky. It's tricky for us and it's tricky for the people that are going through it.
Thank you for that. Listeners that can resonate with some of the things that you're saying, have you got any advice for them?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even feel equipped to be able to give people advice for all the different scenarios that are going on. But I just think being there for someone and have a genuine sense of you want them to be okay and not just there for the good times or there for the times when you think they might be struggling, but actually just being there and having them as part of a community. Because sometimes when people lose that sense of community, they've lost their identity a little bit. And so we see a lot of service leavers. They leave, suddenly they're in Civvy Street. They might have challenges going on with finding work or friends or different social circles. And suddenly they're out, they're lost at sea. They're out there just trying to doggy paddle and keep up. And that's when it becomes tricky. So creating a community that's this go-to hub that someone can go to and on their best days and their worst days, and it doesn't matter, they're part of something that just wants the best for them and for the whole community. That's really important.
And that goes back to where we started, isn't it, with the belonging and community and the bit that you said at 15 when you went into the military. Turning that back to you, because there is also a strong belief that you have to look after yourself or love yourself before you can love or look after anybody else. How do you look after yourself? What do you eat? What do you drink? What do you do for exercise? How do you sleep? How do you make sure that you sleep well? Or do you sleep well?
Yeah, and I think there's a perfect answer to that. If we want to look after our mental health, there's a lot of things involved. We have to be hydrated. We want to eat good food, not processed stuff. There's a lot of rubbish in there that's not going to do us any favours. If we try and create a routine for ourselves, whatever that includes, whether it's a pastime, a hobby, a sport, reading, whatever it is, if we create that structure for ourselves, exercise helps. It stimulates all these different things within us. We feel better about it, particularly if we do stuff early in the morning. We feel like we've achieved something. You've heard the thing about just get up in the morning, make your bed.
You've
achieved something right away. But if we do something that just sets us off on a good trajectory on our day and then our week and then our month and then our year, it's about small steps, isn't it? It's about small steps in everything that you do, then that always helps us. For me personally, if I was preparing for something, it was a football match, a boxing match, you know, I was doing the West Highland Way, it was 100 miles I was going to run. I'd prepare for it. I don't feel I need to prepare for anything. So I have other priorities now, whether it's charity stuff, whether it's work, whether it's spending time with the family. So those things take priority now over other things, which back in the day in the army was about, you know, keeping fit and doing all that stuff, learning new skills. Now it's less about that. It's other things that are priority in my life. And everyone will go through that where they're at a different part in their journey. And so they'll have different priorities, things that are important to them at that time. Yeah. But mental health is the one thing that it's the golden thread that runs throughout all that. And if you want to be the best version of yourself throughout any of that, you have to look after your mental health. You have to make sure that you're okay so that you're putting your best foot forward.
Yeah. And that feels that's coming through there is all those life experiences have really ensured that you focus on the right things at the right time of what you've just explained, your family, your charity work. That past has got you where you are today.
Yeah, and I think everybody's life is about juggling balls because you've got your friends, you've got your family, you've got work, you've got pastimes, you've got sports, things you want to do outside of that. And sometimes you're going to drop those balls, you know, so you're not always going to get that right because life's hard and it throws things at you and you can't always get things right, which is why when you see that anybody that's specifically good at any sort of elite level at anything, whether it could be a sport or could be something in the workplace, sometimes those priorities take precedence over others. So it's no surprise you hear about Olympians that have missed birthdays and weddings and nights out with friends because they've had to drive all their priorities one way. Now, there's nothing wrong with that as long as at the centre of that, your own mental health and the mental health of everyone around you is okay. Then I think if you're getting that right, then you're okay.
You are who you are today because a lot of your experiences were life or death. Nothing gets as drastic as that, does it? And even just mentioning the word Operation Certain Death makes my body just go a bit funny. That is keeping you focused, isn't it, when the stakes are high? What is Operation Certain Death?
Operation Certain Death was the nickname given to Operation Barris, which was the rescue of the hostages out in Sierra Leone.
Okay.
I was part of one of the recce teams in there. And without going into too much details about the operational side, I think a lot of people, when they think very generally on that, think, oh, you've got to be really brave to go into something like Operation Certain Death. And you'll remember from me speaking last night about bravery. And actually, bravery is not about just being fearless or just running into hails of bullets, because we don't want people like that in the SES. We want people that are afraid but are willing to make rational decisions and go forward when they have to. And like I said, it always made it easier for me thinking about the consequences. If I thought about the consequences of going forwards or backwards or doing this or do that, that always helped give me perspective. So it was never about being brave. I've never been brave in my life, but I've always tried to measure up the consequences of whether I do something or don't. And that's always helped drive me in 99% the right course of action. And that should help others too when they're faced with difficult decisions or they're thinking about this is probably not the easy way to go or approach this or, you know, have that conversation or make that decision. Actually, when we think about the consequences of something, what happens if we do and don't, sometimes that helps us make the right decision. So those sort of things certainly help me. And, you know, I've been scared going into plenty of things. You know, you're going to do a hostage rescue on a target and you're outnumbered and there's only a few of you and the risks are high. But then I always thought, I'm going to be scared for the next 60 seconds coming in on a helicopter to do this. These hostages have been there for weeks and months, not knowing if the next moment's their last. And that helped settle me. That helped put my fear into perspective. And so it was able to just calm me and let me focus on the things that were important, because whether I make it out or not, the important thing is that the hostages are rescued. I've got plenty of good people around me that if I go down, they'll take that on. So once you focus in on the important things and measure up the consequences, sometimes that helps you make the decisions you were always supposed to make.
Yeah, you are very humble and it's inspirational listening to the way that you talk. And it's obvious that you give service and you're shining that light on other people. and thinking of other people, that I don't care what you say, there's got to be some bravery into what you're saying. But I can see how you're sort of putting it on the reverse of how the other people feel in this situation that you're in at the time. And that takes a lot of leadership, doesn't it? What does leadership look like to you? It feels like, listening to you, that it's just naturally happening all the time. But again, in a life or death situation, that's massive, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it puts things into perspective. And so if you've been at that end of the consequences are life and death, then everything else should be easier, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when the printer runs out of paper, you know, I can deal with that, you know. So I think those sorts of things help put things into perspectives. No secret that I talk about perspective yesterday, because sometimes when we think we're having our worst day, actually, when we boil it down and we think about things and compare it, we're okay. You know, things aren't going the way we want that day.
Yeah.
You know, I used yesterday as an example with my planes, trains, and automobiles coming down.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you know, I turn up and manage to do what we're doing and nobody dies. And yeah, you have to jiggle things, you have to be able to pivot, but in the end of the day, things work. And so, again, you know, we don't know until we've been through those sorts of things. But everybody has a part of that in themselves. You know, you think, everybody listening, if their house was on fire and their family was inside, they'd all run in and try and help. We have parts of it within ourselves that can come out at certain moments and surprise ourselves, you know, when we need to.
I'm proud of leading an organisation. But it's not just about me, and I know that, and I remind myself about that every single day. Teamwork is just so essential, isn't it? It's another skill.
Going back to leading, I think leading, one of the single biggest things is influence.
Yeah.
So if you can have influence over people to make them do things that perhaps they don't even want to do themselves, that's such a big skill as a leader. Yeah. And there's ways we can do influence. So anytime I had a team, the first hard thing that we had to do, I would do it. Because I would never ask them to do something I wouldn't. I would tell them all my flaws and then my strengths in that order. And that helped people. And that's always the same in teamwork as well. We would always have debriefs, whether things went 100% well or 100% badly. We get people in a room and the first person to stand up would be the person in charge. They'd say, here's all the things that I think I could do better if I was going to do that again tomorrow. And what we could do as a team better. And then they would name all the things that went well. Then they would sit down. And that gave everybody in the room permission to stand up and be honest and accountable and say, actually, here's all the things I think. If I was going to do this again tomorrow, I would do better or I would do differently. And here's all the things I think went well. So that everybody's learning, so that everybody has the freedom to say whatever they want in that room for the benefit that when we walk out that door, we walk out better than we walked through it. So there's a big part about teamwork and accountability, and we've lost a little bit of accountability, I think, same as we went back to about and being able to endure in that resilience piece. And that sometimes when things don't go well, it's everybody else's fault. Or there's a blame culture, or there's a you're not good enough or whatever. But actually, we're all learning. And as long as we're all learning from success or failure, we're all going in the right direction together as a team, because it's the only way it works. Yeah.
If you want to build on your skills and get yourself on the right path to success, visit the City College Plymouth website, cityplym.ac.uk. You can hook up with courses, download information packs, guides, and much more. Or find us on social media. We're Skillfully Speaking Podcast on Instagram and Skillfully Speaking on Facebook and LinkedIn. Skillfully Speaking, where hidden skills are revealed. Now back to the conversation.
Talking generally, would you agree that you would use those skills and you would use those thoughts and ideas in everything that you do? You've already alluded to the transition from the military into civvy world. Is there anything different that you would advise from going from the military back into the civvy world? Or is it just general views that you just would work with every single day anyway?
I think you have to be a bit of a chameleon. And I think the best leaders are chameleons. They're ones that not only can shift to different leadership traits, skills, ways of doing things, but can also change person to person. And it's no secret that the best sort of man managers out there in sports teams, football teams, rugby teams, they're able to deal with individual players at their level to get the best out of them and therefore the best out of the team collectively. Isn't it bizarre that you can get the same players in a football team or a rugby team and with different managers produce very different results?
Yeah.
You have the same players. Yeah. I mean, they should be capable of doing the same things.
Yeah, but no, that is true.
There's obviously something in that that managers can bring out the best in individuals and then as a collective so that the team cumulatively are greater than the sum of their parts. And in many ways, that's what you have to do with the military.
I've just picked up on something that I didn't realise and didn't know until I've just picked up and read it. As an educationalist, absolutely focused on lifelong learning and widening participation. I didn't even know that there was a master's in terrorism and history. So what made you go down an academic route and study something like that? And what inspired you to do that in the first place?
Yeah, so I always think we're always learning through life. And I think I never got a chance to finish school. I was in the army at 15.
Oh, yes, of course.
So yeah. I never got a chance. And it wasn't that I was particularly bad at school. It's that, like anybody, if things aren't great at home, you're not likely to be great at school. And so I left school at 15 without even sitting my O-levels or grades or standard grades or GCSEs or whatever they're called now. So later on in life, I wanted to go back. It felt like one part that was missing. You can say and do everything you like. If there's no education behind you, you're standing on only so many pillars. And so I got bored doing security work. And it's another thing about doing what you're passionate about. It's probably the most money I ever made in the world doing security work and bodyguarding. But, you know, it was boring. And unless you're stimulated cognitively and unless you're passionate about what you're doing, money doesn't really matter. You can only do it short term. You can't really do anything like that long term. So I had a plan, and my plan was to put myself through university. And people look at the successes of university, you know, the MLIT in terrorism, the MA ons, first class in history. But actually, there's a lot of rejection and failure there, which is important and is part of the story, equally more important. So when I was applying to go to university, I went along to Edinburgh University, my local university, and I said, listen, I'm just out the SES. Here's my red book that says I'm a great shot and a fast runner. What year do you want me to go into? Third, fourth, just write my dissertation? They went, no, you need to go to school. You have no qualifications. I thought, all right, okay. So I applied to three local colleges in Edinburgh and I got rejected from them all.
Oh my gosh.
And again, this is where resilience has helped me. I went away and I saw this application. It was a college called New Battle, out by Dalkeith, in the outskirts of Edinburgh, but it had a guaranteed interview. So I went across and I got a place at New Battle Abbey College. And their motto, I think, was Serio Sed Serio, late but in earnest, which kind of summed me up perfectly. And so I went along. You had to take a minimum of 12 subjects. It wasn't all for access to higher education. It was just for mature students who wanted to study or do something. And because I was so interested, but I didn't know what I wanted to do at history at university, I took 20 subjects and I got 20 A's. So I was down there, then I was back up here.
Wow.
So I applied to Cambridge, St Andrews and Edinburgh and I got rejected from them all.
Oh my gosh.
And this is life, isn't it? This is your journey.
Like rejection, my biggest fear.
Yeah. We all go through rejection, but rejection sometimes, once you've been through a lot of it, you're okay with it. So again, looked how I could get in and then they had this interview for mature students. And so I went along to the interview and I got a place. So I had a place, Edinburgh, and I was doing history because I enjoyed doing history. I really enjoyed history. So I applied to do history and I nearly failed my first paper. So I still remember the question. It was Scotland ever conquered? And I said, no. And here's why. And they said, no, you've not answered the question. You've only answered half the question. So I learned the system. I learned how to write properly, how to structure essays, how to put an argument, how history isn't really important, your opinion, it's everybody else's opinion, and then giving your little bit at the end. So I learned the game. Yeah. And my little superpower, I wasn't academic, you've heard me. I didn't have a lot of history experience. I didn't have a lot of experience, good grammar, writing essays. What I did have was resilience. And resilience is your one superpower. So whenever it came to an essay or an exam after that, in military style, I practiced and rehearsed it 20 times until I knew almost to the word how much I could write in 2 hours. Then I went into the exam hall, and by the end of that 4 years, I was the only student to not only have a first class and first of the first, but to win all 3 academic awards. Now, I tell you that not because I'm smart. I tell you that because resilience is the one thing that can trump anything. And if you practice, you study, you put in the hours and you work harder than the person next to you, you're going to get where you need to be.
And what is just so enlightening really is that you had all the practical. So nobody could tell you or advise you because you'd been there and done that. And then trying to fit that into a system just totally went into the opposite direction. But then you had to really fight through and then learn how to do something differently to get through the system. Because I'm quite a disruptor of a system as well. But then when you have to abide by a system to get something, then there's no choice if that's what you want to do.
Yeah, and life's like that. It's easy to talk about, oh, yeah, you know, I got a degree or I did this and that. But actually, the journey is a bit more complicated and it's more interesting.
Yeah.
And it actually has more to it that helps you in other areas. So I think that's why it's more important to talk about the rejection, the failure, the hard work and the resilience side of it, because that's more important than the piece of paper that came at the end of it.
Yeah. And there's something about trying to fit everybody in one box, isn't there, as well? So that's really nice that people can listen to something really substantial that they don't have to fit in a box to succeed either. That's my view on that, really. So you've done your learning. And then obviously a lot of people know you because of your TV career. You were very well known from SAS, Who Dares Wins. So how did that opportunity come about? Because we talked last night, didn't we? There's a bit of luck sometimes and opportunity just happens.
You can be great at anything, but actually being lucky or being at the right place at the right time probably has more credence. And so before I go into all the successes of TV and everything else and all the right place, it's actually worth noting that I spent in excess of a year when I left the military applying for over 1,000 jobs without a single interview. And so I'd been down that path as well. And so no matter how good the CV looked, my experience, my attitude, my interview preparation, I wasn't getting anywhere. And sometimes you can find yourself in that rut. And it's no fault of your own. Sometimes it's a reflection of other people and how they perceive you, or just luck at the time. There's other people that are better than you at that time for roles. But I wasn't having much luck there. But a bit further down the line, I'd been on I think it was called Military Film Services. I was on their website. And it was more to be a military advisor, because I'm one of those ex-military that look at TV programs and go, oh, he's got the rifle back to front. Oh, his berry's not shaped right. Or that would never happen. I'm one of those annoying people. So I thought, rather than just sit and be annoyed at the TV, I'll do something about it.
Yeah.
So I put myself down as a military advisor. And at that time, this is going back a while now, there wasn't a lot of work in it. There is now. There's a bit more work in it, but it's swallowed up by the same sort of one or two guys. So I was still on this website and the guy reached out and said, listen, there's a TV show coming up and it's about the selection process, but it's taking civilians through a kind of mock SAS selection, but it will be run by ex-Special Forces. You'll have all the freedom to run it as you see fit. And that's it. And I thought, well, it sounds like there's quite a bit of autonomy in that. It's not your traditional, you know, are you tough enough type thing. So I thought I'll go along. And when I went along to the initial days, there wasn't any other SES guys. It was all SBS guys.
What's SBS?
Special Boat Service.
Oh, okay.
So traditionally ex-Marines.
Before.
And
okay.
They do the sort of maritime. Certainly traditionally they've done the maritime side of things. The SES Special Air Service, made up from everybody, including Marines. And they have sort of 4 main parts. So they have their boat troop that does what the SAS,
I should have absolutely known that, you know.
Well, not a lot of people know that unless you like that subject. So we cover a lot of the different areas. When I went along, there was these other SBS guys and they said, this is the idea of the show. And it sounded all right. It sounded like we had the freedom to pick who we wanted, put whatever events we wanted to run the process and then choose whoever we wanted. It wasn't quite that way in reality, but that's how it was portrayed at the start. So went on the show, and actually the first couple of series, I really enjoyed it because it felt like they were taking ordinary people with no agenda, no backstory, and just testing them in different environments. But the one great thing about it, and I genuinely believe this, that every single person that came on that had grown a little bit in some area by the time they left. And I really liked that, really enjoyed it. It kind of went a little bit off-piste after that. You know, they started getting celebrities in, and as soon as you get Jordan in, that's you. You've sold your soul, you know. So my love for it sort of grew a little bit apart. But I really enjoyed those first couple of series, and I think that's how I wanted that to evolve, you know. Because if you're an ordinary person sitting at home and you're watching that on the television, you can identify with someone there. You know, you've got the same stuff going on. Whereas if you're a celebrity or you've got this ridiculous backstory, you can't identify with that. That's not who you are. But I thought the first couple of series were really good because anybody could see how they could grow in all these challenging environments, no matter how they perceived themselves. And I really enjoyed that. So, no, it was a great platform for me. It allowed me to do other things. So I'm thankful for the opportunities that gave me. And I love TV, but TV can be quite a fickle industry sometimes. But I certainly enjoy it. And I had a few things lined up before COVID came along and destroyed them. So never say no to being back on TV again.
So being in the public eye, did it change you at all?
It didn't change me, but it had to change a few things. And I'm quite fortunate. I'm up in Scotland. Nobody really cares. And my profile wasn't that massive that every second person in the street was stopping me, but it helped in some ways. So on the charity side, it helped. It helped create a platform and a profile to help the charity grow. It helped do other things that I'm passionate about. And yeah, and it's half of the reason I'm here today.
You've written the memoir, haven't you? The book's right here, called The Pilgrim. Why is it called The Pilgrim?
People that know the SES know that The Pilgrim has connections with the SES, and it's always about, you know, being selfless and on this journey to help others and yourself and everything else. And so I thought it was quite apt. And when you read the book, you see that the journey, there's a bit of connection there with associations with the Pilgrim, but also our rugby team's called the Pilgrim and stuff like that, and, you know, the stuff. So there's a lot of connections there. So I thought it was right as a title. And, you know, I wrote my autobiography in 6 weeks when I left the military, and I did it deliberately. I wrote it so everything was still fresh in my mind. And I never had any intention on really publishing it. I just wanted to have it documented for myself or the family, you know. And it was many years later that I thought there might be a public appetite for a book. And so that's the only reason really I published it. And obviously people that know me will know the difficulties of publishing something as people change in positions every couple of years, the line in the sand of what you can write and what you can't changes, and we go back and forth a lot. So that part was frustrating. But the important thing is eventually we got the majority of that autobiography out.
Anybody reading your book, what would they take away from it?
I think people take different things. And I say that not just with the power of hindsight, but I've been messaged so many times since the book came out by different people getting different things from the book. So at the end of some of the chapters, it'll have a sort of phrase that kind of sums up the flavour of that chapter about challenges that have went on or things that other people might be going through in their life. And that's deliberate. And you'll realise from the opening of the book, it kind of throws you off piste.
Yeah, exactly.
The opening part of it. And that's deliberate as well. You think you know what you're about to read.
Yeah.
That's a hook. You know, that's why it's there. And so hopefully everyone will get something from it because it touches on very different parts of life and things that might be going on in different people's life. And actually gave me all the feedback and comments and success of the book. You know, it sold out in 3 weeks. That gave me the appetite to write the next book, which is a book on resilience, which I'm 3/4 of the way through now.
Fantastic. So when's that due to come out?
It will come out this year. Yeah. When? I don't know, but I'm about 3/4, and it's like anything. For anybody that's, you know, thinking of writing a book, you should. Even if you're not going to publish it, there's something cathartic in writing a book. It never seems the right place to finish. You always think there's things to add. So it will be out sometime this year when I think that the publisher's had enough and they're like, no, you need to just finish it. But now we're nearly there with it.
And is that because you're still reflecting and thinking and taking your time with it to just make sure that it's the right thing, giving the right information?
Yeah, and a lot's went on in the world in the last sort of 10 years.
Yeah, that's true.
The different things have been thrown up. Well, whether it's COVID, whether it's world conflict, economics, standard of living, different, you know, perspectives on what's going on around the world. also feedback from the book of things that people got from it that perhaps aren't necessarily what I might have thought. I thought it would be a lot of people that were just interested in military and SES and bought the books because they bought all the SES books. Actually, the audience has been far wider. And even just from last night, so there was a comment from last night that went up, and it was a woman that said, "I, you know, went along to the talk, didn't think I would really enjoy it. I'm now going to go and get the book."
Oh, really?
And I love that because people will have a perspective of what they think someone is going to be, act, look, say. And when you change that, there's something quite refreshing about that, isn't it? Because you've changed somebody's perspective. So based on a lot of the feedback from different things, people saying, look, I had this going on in my life, reading your book was great, and now I'm going to tackle X, Y, and Z. That sort of gave me the appetite to think, do you know what, there might be something in that. Because you have your own ideas on resilience and you think, well, just my opinion, they're worth 2 pence. But the more you speak about it and the more you feel like there's influence there, you feel like, well, maybe there is value in putting a book out.
That's amazing. There's nothing more empowering than that. Did you know whether it was a student, a member of staff or a parent?
I have no idea.
No idea.
No idea. I think her name was Jackie Grubb, but I'll... I'll tell you after this.
Okay. So there's nothing, is there, as empowering as a motivational speaker. So I just want to unpack that a little bit. So when we say a motivational speaker, and that's what you are, what does that look like for you? We've talked at length about all the resilience and the skills and the teamwork. But actually, if you are a motivational speaker, why does somebody want to come and listen to you to be empowered then to go on and do whatever they need to do next?
Yeah, I always think it's quite a general collective term, motivational speaker.
It is, isn't it?
Because I could go to 10 different talks and you may motivate 10% of the audience in one and 90% in the other. I always say I never have a talk that's off the shelf. I never have a, this is my talk, this is what I run to everyone and that's it. Yeah. Because what will inspire people at school, what will empower Salesforce workers, what will empower, motivate manufacturing or accountants is totally different. Yeah. That's why those briefing calls are important, themes. What are the themes you're trying to get out of the day? Is there a bit in there about resilience? Is there a bit about teamwork or is it leadership? So motivation's a hard one, but it's easy when you're talking about yourself because A, you can't get that wrong. You're talking about yourself. And also because if you can just lay out all your vulnerabilities early, all your failures and stuff, and there's no secret that's why I do that at the start of my talks, you're more likely to encompass a full audience as opposed to, right, everyone pin their ears back. You're not going to be like me, but if you can try and emulate me, you will have half the success I've had and listen how great I am. There's something very different about that. So I think I always picture myself in the audience and think, what would make my ears prick up? What would make me think, actually, that's given me perspective or a different way of looking at things? Or if they can do it, I can. Or they've come through this journey and, you know, they've had their highs and lows, but have managed to find success and get the best out of themselves in this situation. I think there's something in that. And so I've been very fortunate, not only in the kind of sector I've been in and the sort of journey I've been on, that it appeals to a wider audience than perhaps if I was a successful in business or I was an Olympian, where it can be seen as almost encompassing one part of you. Whereas I think that full journey, I think, can sometimes appeal to a wider sector of audience. So I've been lucky that way in that that story has appealed to a wider audience and so has had success in a whole genre of different sectors and different people, as long as you can tailor that talk to make it fit the sort of things that they're looking at. Mm.
There was method in my madness there because I'd been reflecting because obviously I was taken by surprise because you fired the question back at me last night. And then when I was listening to you talking, because you do workshops, don't you, and team building and things like that as well. And I was just thinking, oh, yes, you know, a company or somebody brings a former SAS person. There's definitely a USP. There's definitely something, isn't there, a theme that would excite and empower people, you know, before they even knew you, probably. At the beginning of this week, I was in London and I was doing some speaking to some CEOs of schools across the country on culture and transformation and behaviours. And it's just so reflective of our paths crossing and what we can get from each other. But yours just feels so niche.
I think you have the beauty of the former SES thing probably gets you noticed, it gets you in the door. And then I think it's up to you to then take that and follow through and have impact with that. And I've been fortunate, you know, you don't get to speak for 10 years unless you do have a story that has value. And I've relied on referrals and testimonials and feedback to be able to have that success. And I'm always growing. I'm always learning. I get to see other speakers. That always helps. It gives you perspective. You see things that work, things you take away from. And, you know, it's part of that journey. That journey I was talking about where I spent this year in excess of 1,000 jobs, not a single interview. I was walking down the Royal Mile one day and there was a guy selling the big issue. And I thought, I'll buy that because I'll be selling that soon. And I got it. And on the back page, it was a job and it was for a volunteer role. It was a project worker and the theme was conflict resolution.
Wow.
And I was pretty low in my life at that time. There was lots of things going on, not least the fact that, you know, I hadn't found work for a year. And so I thought, I'll apply for the job. And I got an interview. I thought, I'm going to the interview just
for
the experience.
That's the universe speaking somewhere, isn't it?
I thought, I'm going to the interview just for the experience of having an interview, because I was taking anything I could get at that point. And I went along, there was three women there, and one of the women said, Colin, can you describe a time you successfully resolved a conflict? So 2 hours later, I walked out of there. They all had PTSD. And I got a call and they said, you know, you've got the job. I said, what's the job? They said, you're going to go into schools and teach conflict resolution in these troubled schools we have across central Scotland. Yeah. So I went back to Cyrenians, the charity I was working with at the time. And I said, have you got, where's your material on conflict resolution? They said, we haven't got any. We've just won the contract. You need to make it. So I made this conflict resolution workshop just based off my own kind of experience.
Yeah.
I went into these schools and it had all the success, right? So people were staying in school, people weren't fighting. You know, these were schools that had like police and bouncers and stuff on them and teachers were getting assaulted. That all stopped. And then the independent schools in Edinburgh, of which there are a few, heard about it and they funded it. So then I could have project workers I could train. And then the Prince's Trust heard about it
and they
came along and shadowed me and said, can we use this part as part of our year-long Excel program, which we run throughout the UK?
Oh, my gosh.
And it's the
fantastic.
Third most thing I'm most proud of today.
Oh, gosh.
And it got me at a time, not when I was at my highest and flying. It got me at the time when I was at just about my lowest in life. And people say, that's great. You know, you went in and helped the kids. Nah, the kids helped me. They saved me at a time when I was...
Oh gosh, I'm so happy that that came out then. We are learning all the time, and whoever it is, it's amazing. And when you least expect it, what you're going to pick up and how that shapes your future as well.
Yeah, and I think it's useful to remember that. So one of the things I have now is, at the end of the year, one of the last jobs I applied for, I'd started off quite high, middle management, everything else. And by the end of that year, the last job I applied for was a nighttime security guard at the National Library of Scotland. And I got this letter back and it said, due to the overwhelming calibre of applicants, you've not been selected. So I kept it. I still have it today. It used to be on my wall. Yeah. So when I was struggling at university, when I was struggling with jobs, balance and stuff, family and everything, I just looked at that and it helped. And I still have it now. It's not on my wall, but I've deliberately kept it because we never know where we're going to come, you know, in life and what's going to come at us. But that's there always a reminder, never to stop being hungry and doing the important things and having that appetite. And that's always helped me. And people don't. They like to hide that stuff and have the successes up on the wall. Yeah. But actually, that stuff's quite good as a reminder of where you could be if you just take your eye off the ball and don't do the things that are, you know, important.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I totally agree. This is a bit cheesy, this question. But if you looked at your younger self, is there anything that you would say to your younger self now?
Well, I always say you should never have regrets because anything you did for a reason at that time, where you were, rightly or wrongly, and you can't change it. But what you can do is you can use all those experiences, negative, positive, to shape that little rudder and where you're going in the future. That's your experience. You own that, you know, and so use that as a little rudder just to help change your direction when you think you need to. And so anything that I've ever done in the past, I don't think I would change anything. I think I'd go back when things were uncertain, when I was sort of 12, 13, 14, and just say, it's going to be all right. You're going to be okay.
Do you still remember all of that stuff quite vividly?
Yeah, there's elements of it that I think I protect myself from. So there's elements that I think I've deliberately, my mind said, Colin, you don't want to remember that, so just forget it. And the sort of flashes come up every now and again, little flickers, little like sort of memories. And I think that's deliberate. I think your body does a thing where it says, let's remember the good times. You know, you think back to holidays in the last year and you always remember the highlights, the good times. And those other bits you try and sort of, if you can, put them away in a little closed filing cabinet. So I think sometimes things come back. And actually, that's one of the good things about writing a book, because when you write down your experience, whether you keep a journal, a diary, you write down your autobiography, and they use this as a kind of system with veterans, anybody that's been through trauma, where the process of talking about it or writing it down sheds a layer of it from yourself. The first time I stood up and talked about experiences as a child in the military operations, I felt like I was in the room. I felt like I was reliving it. Now when I say it, it feels like I'm talking about this guy Colin I used to know back in the day. He used to be a little kid and I remember how he used to live. So there's something in that, rightly or wrongly, good or bad, that we shed layers. So if anybody's going through that, just the process of writing it down or speaking about it almost sheds a layer of it, and there's something that really helps you in that.
Yeah, that's really important. So what's next then?
As you probably heard last night, I think having that sort of can-do attitude and I'll give it a go has led to lots of things that I'm able to do now. So whether it's public speaking, whether it's motion capture and stunts for video games, doing the workshops, doing the charity stuff, it's always because I thought, I'll just give it a go. And if it doesn't work out, that's fine, because equally you have anything, if not more, rejection and failure for other stuff. So yeah, I don't know. There's obviously another book on the horizon. Yes. I love doing the talks, the workshops. I have my team building company, Stoic Events. We have a big area in Scotland. We have our helicopters, our weapons, our canoes, our vehicles, and we take companies on spy missions for the weekend. Team building, they all come together. They don't know what the mission is. They don't know how long they're out for, what they're going to do, but they slowly unravel the mission as they go through the sort of couple of days or day, whatever they're going to do. And I really enjoy that. And I hope that's something that grows over the coming years, because it deserves success. You know, it's a good product and I like to see people grow at the end of it. There's something in that, you know, in a different world, maybe I would have been a teacher. I always say that.
Well, if you ever want to do anything.
You know, it's teachers that saved me. You know, when I was at school, I never used to take a shower at school, because then people would see what I look like. So at cross country every year, you had to go for a shower. It was mandatory. Yeah. And I walked in the shower, everyone left, and the PE teachers came in and said, can we speak to you in the office? And then I had to kind of show them. I was like tarting down my back and stuff. And they got in social services and everything. But that was brave of them at the time, because there was probably a lot more of that going on at that time. And so it was a brave thing for them to do. And I'm glad they did, because without that, there wouldn't have been social services, you know, there wouldn't have been children's panels, NSPCC, and probably I'd have been on a different trajectory. So I always say that when I go and speaking at schools, I owe a lot to teachers for shaping that trajectory at that time.
Gosh, you have just been an absolute inspiration. So it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today, and thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Had a blast.
Skillfully Speaking is supported by Babcock International. Visit babcockinternational.com. Presented by Jackie Grubb. Produced by Paul Philpott. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video content by Mark Stevenson. Coordinated by Louise Greenleaf. Produced by Fresh Air Studios. Copyright City College Plymouth. All rights reserved.